but he understood that I was concerned about his spiritual welfare. Now, you play baseball for a couple of years, but eternity is a long time.
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios.
Today, we have Paul Brosi, Team Coordinator for Friends in Action International. Paul, welcome to episode 88 of the American Grown Podcast.
Well, thank you. It is a privilege to be here.
Thank you for being here. So on your email signature, it says, moving earth to share heaven. What does that mean to you?
Well, Austin, that's kind of the catchphrase, if you will, with Friends in Action, because Friends in Action is a construction mission. We use earth-moving equipment, and we've built roads, done some construction project. We have one right now that we're in the process of getting organized where we will be putting in 16 miles of water line.
Wow.
In the country of Vanuatu. And the whole project is designed to bring fresh water to 30 villages who now have to walk half hour to 45 minutes to get a bucket of water from either a spring or a river. And who knows what kind of purity you're going to find there.
Quality of the water, yeah. The
quality of water can be really questionable. So, but this project's going to mean that we have to, first of all, build a roadway, which means moving earth. It means that we're going to have to dig trenches and bury the water line. It's going to mean the work of plumbers to put the pipes in, excavators and loaders to backfill, and just to create enough project opportunity there for a number of volunteers to get involved. And this probably will take 3 to 4 years.
Wow.
To get the 16 miles put in, because we're going through a mountainous virgin area. So we're going to have to be very careful.
Okay.
We have to have experienced operators. We don't want to have a greenhorn trying to work with an excavator on the side of a mountain.
No.
We want somebody who knows what they're doing. But the opportunity came to us because a local pastor, and he came to our executive director then, Tim Johnson, who has now moved to a different position. But he said, Mr. Tim, he says, if we can get the water to these 30 villages, they will invite me in, and I can tell them about the living water, the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So we said, that's a good trade-off. So we began working with the government. We brought in engineers. We brought in some college personnel to help lay out the path. But we are presently now on task. We have approvals. We got some equipment shipped over there just 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And so we now have some equipment that's basically on site, and we're getting ready to actually to dig a roadway, and
wow.
we're dropping 1,500 feet, going a total of 16 miles or thereabouts. So there'll be a lot of head pressure, so that has to be all engineered. So there's a lot of back story.
Yeah.
To a project like this. But that emphasizes our logo. We're moving earth, and what we're doing is we are changing the spiritual scope of the people that we're going to.
I love it. Yeah, you're literally moving earth to share the gospel, to help these people, these villages, you know, these impoverished areas that need help. I mean, to bring water to people, that's amazing.
Well, and you have to figure these villages that have never had fresh water brought to them.
They always had to go walk and get it.
They had to walk and get it. Miles. Usually it's the women and the children that do that.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's culturally, we have to be asked to come in. And so it's not just a matter of us coming and saying, hey, we're here to help you, and this is what we're going to do. Now, we have to ask, and then they will invite us in. And the big question has come different places is, why would you come to help us? And so at that point, we can tell them, well, as Christians, we believe God desires for everybody to hear the good news of Jesus. And as a construction company, we do what we can to help you so that you realize that the love of God that's in us is being gifted to you.
And it fits, like you said, so well with your logo and everything. And there will be photos up on Facebook and Instagram on American Grown Podcast for everyone listening. So again, thank you for being here. I want to get some backstory, Paul, on your early childhood. I know on the form to be on the podcast, I mean, you're lucky to even be here, because reading that, you survived a 25-foot fall off of a barn roof, and you almost had, I guess, a near heart attack up in the north woods of PA, and here you are. So let's get your backstory. What was your early childhood like? You know, what did your parents do for work? And then take us through up until where we are now.
Wow, that, when, I guess to start it off, I would say that I was actually born in California. My mother was attending college there, met a man. They got married. The marriage did not last more than a short time. I don't know how long it was. All I know is that as a infant, or I would say less than a year old, we moved back to Pennsylvania. And I don't know all the circumstances. Don't need to know the circumstances, but born in the West Coast. But I grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania. And my dad, and I'm going to refer to him as my dad now, even though I really never met my birth father. But my dad had a job in a factory putting together boilers for submarines. And then had this little 40-acre farm that he had on, kind of a hobby farm, but we raised our own beef. We had a couple horses. Raised pigs. We had some chickens every now and then. You know, small farm.
40 acres, though. That's a nice size of land, you know?
Well, it is for a gentleman's farm. It's put it that way.
Okay.
40 acres is hardly enough to raise a dairy herd because of all that all goes on with that. But we grew up there. I learned to work hard. As a small child, you did all the things that small kids do on the farm, like weed gardens and mow the grass.
The fun stuff.
Yeah, right.
Right. The stuff that mom and dad didn't want to do or didn't have time to do.
Well, maybe. It taught us how to work. I don't begrudge that at all. But I milked the cows in the afternoon. We had hand milkers. We had two Jerseys that we milked. So we had homemade butter. We drank all the milk we could drink, and mother canned, and so it was just a real homey lifestyle that we lived. And we learned to hunt and trap. I learned to enjoy the outdoors and to run the woods and deal with snapping turtles down the creek, you know, all those fun things.
Snapping turtles, they can be vicious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But they're fun to play with.
You gotta watch your fingers. They can take it off. From what I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you play with snapping turtles. Any sports or anything? Music? What were you kind of into at school?
Not music.
Not music. Okay. Yeah, couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, right?
Well, in a bucket, but I mean, it echoed in there.
I got you. Yeah, I would say I'm the same. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We as a kid, I think it was 12 years old, we could legally hunt. And so that's when we got my first shotgun. And
okay.
We would hunt small game, pheasants and rabbits and squirrels, and did that all through my teen years. In fact, right up the morning of my wedding, I was hunting squirrels. So
that's great. Okay. So the morning of your wedding, you're hunting squirrels.
Well, I got to relax somehow. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to unwind somehow. Go hunt some squirrels. I've never went squirrel hunting, but I imagine you got to be quick. So squirrels are quick, you know?
Well, yeah. And yeah. Oftentimes they'll be running across the tops of trees. And so that's always fun to kind of lead them and,
yeah.
And kind of, well, to hunt the squirrels.
Exactly right. We'll leave it at that. I know what you're saying. Yeah. So your wife, what did she think, you know, your wedding day and everything?
Well,
and how did you meet? Let's ask that question. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me back up then a little bit. In high school, I always attended a church. It was a good Bible believing church. I guess I was a senior in high school. We had a missionary conference, and the missionary there, really, what he spoke, I couldn't tell you who he was. But all I know is that the Spirit spoke to me and says, Paul, I want you to be involved in missions. And it wasn't an audible voice, but it was just something that really tugged at my heart. And I knew that I needed to attend Bible college if I was going to be a missionary. I knew that then. Today, I would say you don't have to attend a Bible college to be a missionary. If you attend a good trade school and learn how to swing a hammer or be a plumber, we can use you with Friends in Action, because that is what we do. Back then, the norm was you go to Bible college, you get a Bible education, and then you go out and you teach or you preach or you do whatever missionaries do. And so I attended Philadelphia College of Bible, now Cairn University. When I attended PCB, as I'll call it, it was downtown Philadelphia, 18th and Arch. And so the Center City was our campus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Big city compared to Lebanon County or you know, yeah.
Yeah. It was.
Or the farm.
It was a huge jump for me coming off the farm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to see buildings as high as the trees or higher than the trees that were on the farm. So anyways, it was there that I met Kathy. I explained to her that, you know, I felt God's call on me, and she was in agreement with that. And I guess it was on a Valentine's Day that I proposed to her. And so in Center City, we agreed to be lifetime partners. And that was September. That'll be 52 years ago.
Whoa, congrats.
So that's where we met. And shortly after we were married, when I got married, I had a job. Working my way through college, I had a job as an iron worker. I worked on various bridges. Those familiar with the area would know that there are road bridges over 283, and I helped to build those some of those bridges. Worked with a contractor from Lebanon, and one of the first jobs I had, I was on the job, and he was teaching me how to tie rebar. And he says, by the way, I'm going to introduce you, and I forget the guy's name, but a guy who was just fresh out of the Marines. And so this guy fresh out of the Marines said, okay, Paul, what we're going to do, we're going to grab that load of steel, and we're going to lay it out. And I looked at it, and I said, well, how many of them? He said, all of them.
Whoa.
So, we grabbed what we could get our hands around.
Yeah.
And these steel rods were I think they were 20 foot long.
Okay.
Well, I learned in a hurry that this guy had muscles coming out of his ears. And by the end of summer, I had shoulders of leather because of carrying the steel rods.
Yeah.
On. But that fall, when I went back to college, and we were beginning our working out for the wrestling season, which I joined.
Okay.
In college. which is a beater because I didn't have the experience. I learned it in college.
Oh, I see you're saying. Yeah.
But I was squatting 300 pounds. I was squatting what the heavyweights were squatting.
That's impressive. And
I wrestled 129 to 136 or something like that.
That's from lifting all that rebar.
Yeah. And so it gives a little bit, you know, I had that kind of a background. And when we got married, one of the things that I did then was to work as an iron worker for a while. And did some construction with a company that did barn buildings. And so we built these steel barn buildings and small garages and different things, but it was basically a steel construction. That didn't last, I'm going to say maybe 8 or 9 months. For various reasons, I decided to move on. One was I didn't have to travel as far. I got a job with a local construction company. And there I learned to be a carpenter. I learned how to put things together with wood. And one thing I learned early is when someone asked me to help them out, I did not say no. And so I learned a ton of stuff on my own. I had a neighbor that wanted me to lay up some block for a small addition on their house. And I agreed to it. Never laid block in my life.
No experience. You had no experience. Wow.
The only experience I have is watching a friend of mine who was a Mason.
Okay. Okay. So a little bit, maybe.
A little bit. Yeah. So anyways, well, what she didn't tell me was that the block we were going to be using had come from a previous building, so I had to clean it, which means I had to knock all the old mortar off first.
Yeah.
And these were 12-inch block, not 8-inch. So they were heavy block.
Heavy, yeah.
And so I laid up this thing with 12-inch block and probably didn't make a whole lot of money, but I learned a lot. And so that's how I basically learned my general construction, by not saying no. Someone needed something painted. Never did much painting, but hey, I can learn.
Yeah.
And so
learn on the fly.
I learned on the fly, and I had there for a while. I had a opportunity to paint commercially. I was with a painting product that would advertise you can paint barn roofs with it, and that it would extend the life of the barn roof 8-10 years or something like
that. Wow. Yeah.
Well, you got to think about that. I mean, to go up on a barn roof and paint a barn roof. And now we're talking about some risk involved.
Right.
But when you're young and invincible, you don't look at the risk so much. And so we had another young man who graduated from a college, and he was interested in missions, but he wasn't ready to go yet. So the two of us, for a summer, painted barn roofs.
Painted barn roofs.
Yeah. One guy would be on the peak with a rope holding the other guy while he painted, and then we reversed it.
Was that how you did it?
Yeah, that's how we did it.
For safety. Okay, so to tie it back in then, how did you... Because you survived a 25-foot fall off of a barn. Is that when you were painting?
No.
Barns, that's totally different.
Yeah, that was totally different. So anyways, then then when we, after, just fast forward a little bit.
Yeah.
But after Kathy and I were married, we did 6 months of mission work up in Alaska. They needed some carpenters to do interior finishing. They had the rough carpenters that could do the outside stuff during the summer, but they needed things like drywall finished. They needed drop ceilings done. They needed doors hung.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of thing. And I had that experience, so I went up for the winter. We arrived in November in Alaska, and when we got off the plane, it was 40 below. And
wow. I can't even comprehend that. 40 below. Jeez.
So we flew into Anchorage, and the missionary personnel was there to pick us up. And while we're in Anchorage, we're doing shopping, and we had this truck, and we're loading this truck up with all kinds of stuff. Well, I come to realize that the mission station was 186 miles north. Oh. And so we traveled north 186 miles and got into a little compound where the radio, there was a radio station, there was a Bible college, a little a clinic that handled medical issues for that general area. So anyways, for 6 months then, my wife and I were there. Was very interesting. That part of Alaska, just a little tidbit here. At 40 below, you don't make snowballs. It's like walking through feathers. But there were, snow was on the power lines. Snow was on the trees. So that told me there was no wind. Because any kind of wind would blow snow off a power line. So we had virtually no wind. It was 40 below. You could wear layers, and actually, it wasn't really terrible.
Yeah,
I mean, it was cold.
It was cold, right? Yeah, definitely cold, but no wind.
There was no wind, and helped. Yeah. And you bundle up, and everybody's bundled up the same, and
yeah.
and you're doing things, and so it was a
wow.
It was now, a great experience.
Yeah,
but then,
please,
but
yeah.
but then in January. It got cold. It went to 60 below.
Then it got cold. Then it went to 60 below. Jeez. Wow.
So it was the one experience I remember during that time is I opened the front door and threw a glass of water out, and it was ice before it hit the ground.
Really? It froze that quickly?
Yeah.
Wow. That's cold.
That's cold.
That's cold. Wow. So, you know, you're up in Alaska. You returned back to PA? You returned home?
Well, yeah, we came back to PA. They wanted us, the mission there in Alaska, they wanted me to come back and be the maintenance supervisor for the Alaska Bible College. They wanted to break that part off, and I was going to be in charge of all the maintenance. But they needed us to take some, what they called cross-cultural training, where we were in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
The Athabascan Indians and other Indian groups were in the area, so we had to learn what it meant to be able to communicate with people in a cross-cultural setting. So my wife and I accepted that challenge, and we went to Detroit, where we went to a cross-cultural institution, and for 9 months,
yeah.
we learned how to communicate cross-culturally, actually did a little work with some Indians in just north into Canada, and so it was a very interesting 9 months.
Yeah. What an experience, yeah.
But after that time, my wife and I did not have peace together about going back to Alaska. The big question come to my mind, Lord, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
I thought this is where we were headed, and the mission director there with the cross-cultural says, Paul, why don't you consider something stateside? And so he suggested Village Missions. And so my wife and I applied with Village Missions. She was agreeable with that and said, well, let's try that, see what God has in mind.
Yeah.
And so we were accepted with Village Missions. They wanted me to pastor a small church out in the state of Washington.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right. Yeah. We're in Pennsylvania, right?
Right.
And now we're going
East
to
Coast,
Washington.
To West Coast.
Well, at least it's not Alaska, but I mean.
Yeah, it's not going to be, negative 60, 60 below. Wow. Okay. So you go to Washington. I mean, I've never been out towards Washington. So what was that experience like?
It was very different because where we were, there was a lot of timber. Okay. So you didn't have the open farmlands. You didn't have the dairy farms and all the things that I was used to,
mm-hmm.
but timber was a big thing. We had loggers in the church, and we had people who were involved in heavy equipment and that sort of thing. And I had never pastored before. In fact, my training in Bible school was mm-hmm. To be a Christian ed or to be a teacher.
Okay.
So, I grew up in church. I listened to a pastor all the time. I figured, well, how hard can this be?
Give it a go, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty hard.
Well, yeah. you get to respect, you know, for pastors, you know, and what they, yeah, what they have to come up with. But yeah.
So it was all the preparation for the sermons and the practicing it. And obviously, the more you do it, the more comfortable you get. But that was just one aspect of it, because being a pastor in a small community like that involved me getting out and visiting people, mm-hmm. and letting people know that there's a full-time pastor. I was the first full-time pastor in that community.
Oh, wow.
So I was around knocking on doors and introducing myself.
Yeah.
Getting chased by dogs, you know, all kinds of fun
stuff. All kinds of stuff. Yeah. You had some work to do being the first pastor in that, you know, in that area. Yeah, I like that.
So.
Wow. Chased by dogs. you learned to get over fences pretty quickly, maybe.
Well, get back in my car real quick.
Right. Yeah, that's good.
I knocked on the front door and two Dobermans came around the side.
Ooh.
And I'm thinking, you know what?
Big dogs. Yeah.
I'll leave a note here and I'm out of here.
Yeah, yeah. See you next time. Yeah.
But fortunately, there wasn't a lot of that. But I was also getting involved where people were involved. I was involved with the first responders as an ambulance driver.
Okay.
I had advanced first aid and rescue, and I was getting in, and I was actually helping people with those kind of issues. So it was very relational kind of outreach.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't depend on my sermons. I depended on getting out and letting people know who I am and letting them know why I was there. Again, the gospel was the important thing in all that.
Mm-hmm.
While we were in Washington, we had our first three children.
Okay.
And so we had three little ones. And after about 5 years there, the church had grown.
Yeah.
From 20 hit and miss to 60 regular.
Whoa, that's nice. Very good.
So that was a pretty good point. But the leadership of the church at that time felt as though they were ready for someone who had more experience.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure what that meant, except I knew I wasn't the person they were.
Yeah.
When they said they needed someone with more experience, it means that I didn't have what they were looking for. And so my wife and I then came back to Pennsylvania.
Okay. Gotcha. So, yeah, let's take a quick sip break. How about that?
Good.
Yeah. Paul, you're doing phenomenal, though. Yeah. It's amazing. Everywhere you've been so far, and we're not even at Friends in Action yet, you know.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. All the things you've experienced in life, and we're not even at the peak of you know, this story. So, yeah, so you come home to PA. From what I remember, you start your own construction company.
Is that
about right? Yeah.
Well, and the reason the reason we came back,
mm-hmm.
First of all, the Village Missions would have sent me to another church.
Okay. That's right. Yeah.
They would have been glad to send me to another church and pick up a ministry somewhere else. But the whole experience was pretty difficult on us. Number one, I felt like I had failed.
Really?
Well, you asked to leave.
Yeah, but you grew the church, and well, people were coming regularly.
Oh, I know, but I'm just saying how I felt is that, wow. Because, and again, I'm going back in my heritage and my understanding. The pastors that I knew were there in those churches forever.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
They were there 15, 20, 25 years. And 5 years didn't cut it. You know, and I'm saying, whoa, maybe pastoring isn't for me. So I felt like a failure. My wife felt like she was not cut out to be a pastor's wife. And so with all that internal turmoil and uncertainty, we came back to Pennsylvania, and I picked up my hammer again.
Mm-hmm.
And for the winter, we worked with a farmer. When we came back, it was in 80, 81, 82. The economy had taken a dip. and there wasn't a lot of work available. There was a farmer that needed a building taken down. He needed some field work done, some trees trimmed, and, you know, just a lot of general stuff that gets done in the wintertime. As we came back right around Christmas. It was in December when we came back. So I took that job, and for the winter, I did whatever he needed done. And then come spring, he let me know that he was going to have to let me go, that he didn't need, you know, I'd done plenty of work for him, but it wasn't sustainable for the long haul. And someone needed a basement remodeled, and so I remodeled the basement. And then someone needed something else done, and next thing I knew, I was in business for myself.
Okay.
Worked by myself for a while, and then my friend Steve needed some help because he was out of college but not on the mission field yet, and so I took him on, and he helped me, and we did work together. Steve and I are the ones that worked on the barn roofs.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I had some exciting experience there where, you know, the rope was very definitely needed. And
yeah, that's, I mean, you're up there, like you said, you know, 25, 30 feet up.
And so anyways, Steve goes off to, he gets accepted and he's off to his mission work. I hire a couple other guys, and next thing you know, I'm building a house, I'm doing remodeling, I'm flipping a house, I'm doing some store renovations. I did work down at Rockville Square, and
oh wow,
actually revamped a couple stores in at the big shopping mall there in Lancaster.
Down Lancaster County, right? Yep.
So at the peak of my business, I had two crews gone with 16 men. I had hired. But my forte was working in remodeling and the store renovations. We had one company that installed the store fixtures, and they would have liked me to work for them full time. They would have sent me all over the United States putting in store fixtures. My crew did not want to travel all over the United States.
Right.
So I
and you had three young children back at home.
Well, I had a fourth one by that point.
So four kids back at home. Yeah. Kathy probably wouldn't be thrilled if you're all over the country, you know.
Definitely not thrilled about that.
Yeah.
So, anyways, from there, I was in business then for about 30 years.
Okay.
In 08, when the economy went south. My phone stopped ringing, and I needed to find, looking for work. I had now a family I had to care for. I had an offer as an insurance adjuster, working for an online, warranty company.
Yeah.
And, there was work going on in Texas and the Carolinas. And, so he was warranting that kind of work, and so my job was to, when the warranty claim came in, to evaluate it, to call for an engineer to check it out, and I was sitting behind a desk looking at a computer, working, had a phone glued to my ear, you know, and 4 years of that, and I'm saying, Lord, get me out of here.
It doesn't seem like you, for the little bit I know of you, Paul. It doesn't seem like.
Well, it was kind of fun for the first year. I'm learning something new.
Yeah.
It was okay. Now I'm going to perfect it the second year. The third year, things are starting to wane off. The fourth year, I'm saying, Lord, I need to get out of here.
Right.
And that was a time that Tim Johnson visited our church. Tim was the executive director of Friends in Action. And he visited the life group we were in, and just talked a little bit about Friends in Action. And Kathy looked at me and she said, "Paul, that's you."
Yeah.
So so we set up an appointment, a 1-hour appointment, just to meet with Tim, just to learn more about Friends in Action. 3 hours later, we were pretty much sold that this is where God was calling me.
A good meeting, yeah. 3 hours later, okay.
As you say, the rest is history.
Yeah.
More or less. because the first project they gave me was to build a new international headquarters. And that new headquarters is located between Elizabethtown and Middletown. And it was a $3 million project, the largest project I had ever been in charge of.
Yeah, sounds like a very big project.
So
no pressure. Right? Obviously, you did well because you're still with them, but wow. Yeah.
So we're working with a general contractor, and basically I just organized and made sure all the subs were there on time when they needed to be to get the work done. Yeah. And so we've been in our new building now probably for, I'm going to guess, 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's been a very good experience. Once the new building was built, then they wanted me to expand and get some experience in leading teams. So I led teams to Nicaragua, was down there several times, had an interesting opportunity. Mission work oftentimes is dealing with the less known people. Mm-hmm. Is dealing, especially our kind of work, because our mission objective is to get the gospel to the least reached people groups of the world.
Yeah.
And we're using construction as the open door, or as the door, as, you know, as a door opener, so that we can then be able to work with another mission agency and present the gospel. So I like to say we do what we do best so the missionary can do what he does best.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, the missionary was trained to learn languages. He was learned to translate. He was learned to plant churches. He was, you know, it was the spiritual focus.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect. I say that with a kind of tongue-in-cheek because all that we do is spiritual focus. As a believer, as a follower of Christ, coming here is spiritual focus.
Mm-hmm.
Want to pick up my hammer and I build a pavilion for a missionary. You know, that's mission focus. That's gospel work. And so what we do, though, is what they're not really skilled at.
Yeah.
You know, I'll bring in a carpenter and a plumber and bring in five people who are really willing to help, maybe not really skilled, but we get a couple skilled people who can kind of direct, and they have helpers. Yeah. We get a couple cooks, we have good eating.
That's important.
Yeah,
that's important.
It really is.
Keep morale high. Yeah, yeah. Keep people.
If people eat good, if they sleep good,
yeah,
they will work good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a little bit of the approach that we take. What an opportunity then to do that, like down in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
So I used my skills there. The one trip, they wanted me to build a little addition onto a small building, but they're going to put a new generator in there. They gave me a couple of the local Rama men to help me. Typically, they would be the ones to mix the mud. It's all mixed by hand. They were the ones that carried the block there.
Mm.
And then I laid the corner up about four courses high. And it's something like, you know, it was almost like the Holy Spirit tapped me on the shoulder and said, Paul, teach them how to do it. So I called Jose over and I said, Jose, you know, I don't know the Spanish. And so I'm saying, you know, I'm going to teach you how to do this. You know, I'm kind of, you know, we played that game. It was a charades.
Charades,
yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, we're
communicating to the best of your abilities.
Yeah,
right.
Communicating here. And so he called on what I was trying to do and showed him how use a line to stretch it and how you, when you follow that line, your wall gets, and so it took them longer, but they learned how to do it.
Yeah. Isn't there a saying, and I'll probably mess it up a little bit, but, you know, I think it's something like show a man to fish, he'll fish for a day. But if you teach a man to fish, or person, however you want to word it, to fish, they fish for a lifetime. You know, if you educate someone, then they learn it, then they can continue to do it, then they can teach the next generation and so forth. So, like, that's what you were doing.
That's exactly what I was doing.
Yeah.
But see, what was very interesting about this is that the Rama people were considered the, for lack of a better term, I'm going to be a little crass here maybe, but they're considered the dirt of the earth. Even local Nicaraguans look down on the Rama people. They're an indigenous people. They, quote, don't know anything, you know, and so they fish for their food, and, you know, it's very lower class, if you will. Mm-hmm. I don't like saying that, but that's how they were viewed. For me to teach Jose how to lay block was a huge step. Not only a huge step in what his ability was, but it was a huge step in the eyes of Jose, because I respected him.
Yeah.
You know, and because I respected him, on the day that we were going to leave, and I can almost picture it yet, there was a hill went down to the water where the boat was, but we had to take a boat up to a small port, and then from there catch a plane to Managua, and from there back to the United States. So it was a process. We're there on the top of the hill, and we had gotten our luggage down to the boats, and we were just waiting. I don't know what for, but we were waiting. Mm-hmm. And Jose was there. He introduced me to his wife and his two little munchkins.
Yeah.
And was talking with me. And that was very unusual for the Rama people to do that, because they knew they were the dirt of the earth. And they knew that they weren't respected, and so they just kind of kept it themselves. For him to come and to introduce me to his wife and his children was just huge. It was a huge cultural step.
Yeah.
And we were talking there, and in Nicaragua, the big sport, if you will, is baseball.
Really?
It's not soccer.
I thought soccer right away. I was like, oh, he's going to say soccer. It's baseball.
It's baseball.
Okay.
In fact, when we flew in from Bluefields to Managua, and you fly over the jungle area, you see a little village, and in the middle of the village, there's a baseball field.
Baseball.
You see this baseball field.
Yeah.
And so Jose was part of a baseball team. The island where we weren't working on an island, but they working with a village that was on an island, and the island was overcrowded.
Okay.
So part of what we were doing as Village Missions was expanding to the homeland, or to the mainland, I should say, and teaching them how to build homes. And then we were also, one trip I was down, I taught them how to build a hip roof, which diverts wind. And so when they have heavy winds, like they have with the storm that's going on right now down there, why the wind will divert off of the roof, and it'll help the house to stand up better. So we teach them those things, then they can do it. And yep. So, anyways, he says, Pablo, which is Paul in Spanish. He says, how much does a baseball glove cost? And I'm saying, well, Jose, you know, it's been a long time since I bought one. And I said, probably $40. At least get a used one for that. And he said, oh, well, $40 for him was like 2 weeks to a month of labor.
Wow. Yeah.
There's no way. There's no way he's going to spend a month of income to...
For just a baseball glove.
For a baseball glove.
Right.
When they play baseball, they all share gloves. When they don't have a backstop, and they play baseball. I mean, it's hard ball. It's hard pitching.
Wow.
And so when foul balls go back into the jungle, the little kids go back in the jungle, and they find those balls.
Yeah. It's so, thick jungle, too, not just...
Well, by the time they run through it a couple times, it thins down.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
Wow.
It is... That's the setting we're in. And mm-hmm. when I looked at the bats, those were hand-carved bats. So,
wow.
That's a love for baseball, when you're willing to...
Yeah. Run into the jungle looking for a small ball, hand-carved bats, and, you know...
They were pretty smooth, but, I mean, you could tell...
Yeah.
That they weren't machine made.
Milled, right.
Yeah. So anyways, I come back to the United States and I'm scratching my head. And so I go down to play it against sports in Lancaster.
I know right where you're at. I got some golf clubs there. I'm not good at golf, but yes. Anyway, continue.
So I went in there and I found an infielder's glove. Jose told me he played third base. And so I bought the glove. And I also bought him a Spanish Bible.
Yeah.
And I stuck the Spanish Bible in the glove and kind of tied it together, wrapped it up. And our executive director was heading back down in a couple of weeks, so he took it down and gave it to Jose.
Oh, wow.
Well, Jose eventually wrote me a letter. And Tim translated it, because he wrote it in Spanish, and Tim translated it in English. And basically the letter said, Paul, I've never had a friend like you who would show me and teach me. I want to thank you. And he said, and the Bible that you sent, the local missionary told me that is my way of getting out of the spiritual darkness that we have here. And I want to thank you, because that will help me and my family to get out of the spiritual darkness that binds the people. Oh, and by the way, thank you for the glove.
Yeah.
The key thing is, not that he got a baseball glove, which he loved, but he understood that I was concerned about his spiritual welfare. Now, you play baseball for a couple of years, but eternity is a long time.
Very long.
So when you can change someone's heart attitude so they accept Christ, and now they have eternal life instead of just a fun life, it makes getting to know Jose, teaching him how to lay block, watching him play baseball, actually playing baseball with him for a little bit, fun thing.
Yeah. And it's a lasting impact too.
It's an eternal impact.
For him and his whole family, I mean, that whole area.
See, and that's just one example of what we do as a mission.
Yeah.
We do the construction. We've been back to Nicaragua. They built a little walking bridge over to the ball field because it was kind of around the way.
Okay.
And so they built a little walking bridge, and to have some college kids come down and help with that. And it shows again that we respect them as people. And they are involved, and we're expressing the love of Christ to these people. Well, doing that really is the essence of what Friends in Action is all about. Why do we drill wells in West Africa? We're asked, why would you white people come over here and help us black people? Well, it's because your heart needs Jesus the same as anyone else's heart.
Yeah, same. Yeah, yeah.
And we're here to show you the love that we have experienced. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about this love that you know. And so the opportunity opens up, and the local missionary then, he's there teaching the God's word while we're drilling wells. And when they hit water and water blows everywhere, while everybody's out in the water and they're dancing around, and it gives validity to the fact that God is the God of resources, as well as he is one who is concerned for your spiritual welfare, for your eternity. Mm-hmm. And so we work hand in hand. We've been asked to look at a project in Papua New Guinea. And it'll be a large building for an air hangar, a hangar for an airplane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the missionary aviation program over there can shuttle missionaries in and out of very deep areas back in the jungle. And we've had the opportunity to go in there and actually build airstrips in those deep jungled areas. One place we had to take a piece of equipment apart and fly it in with a helicopter, and then had a mechanic put it together in there, and to build the airstrip. And so those are the kinds of projects that Friends in Action is willing to take on.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, humans, right, people in general, want to be respected, want to be loved, and cared for. And what you're doing at Friends in Action is, I think, ticking all those boxes or making sure that that is being done. Because if you respect somebody, it shows that, that you care. And by, you know, spreading the gospel, you know, you're spreading love.
I think what's important to realize is when I view that what I'm doing now is using the skills that I have developed, you got to go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the beginning was that I got my education, my spiritual education. I thought I was going to be a pastor in Alaska, or a missionary in Alaska.
Up in the 60 below,
yeah, freezing. Up in the place where the bears and the moose and everything else run around, you know?
Yeah.
And that didn't work out. And then I was a pastor, actually pastoring for 5 years, and I thought I'd failed. But I think what was happening was, is God says, okay, phase two of your education is now over. Now we're going to go to the next phase. This phase is going to be a 30-year phase. He didn't tell me that, but it turned out to be a 30-year phase. And I learned how to improvise. I learned how to learn and not say no, you know, and I've learned to build houses. I've learned to do light commercial work. I've learned to operate some equipment. And so what do I do now? You know, now all that education, all that background, I'm now using to the fullest.
Wow.
And so when we look at, when I look back and think that I may have been a failure, I think it was just a matter of God saying, this classroom is closed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're going to open up another one. This is a bigger door. It's a bigger room. You're going to be here for a while.
Different challenges.
And then he closes that door, and he opens Friends in Action. And he says, okay, what you learned back there, what you learned in that big room, now you're going to put it into practice.
Right. That's a great way to look at life.
And so when I, as a team leader, I get out in Vanuatu, and something doesn't go right. Well, I've learned to improvise. Okay, and so I say, okay, guys, I'll tell you what. The container didn't come, and it had all the steel rod in we were going to be building with. I said, but the equipment here needs some repair. And so the welders are working on the equipment, getting it, and the mechanic is working on getting things up and running again. And so we improvise, and when the container finally is freed out of port and we open it up, then we go back for the last part of our trip there, and we do what we came to do in the first place. But it's that learning to improvise. It's that learning to say, well, what is it that we can do to move forward? With the background I had, it didn't, it was a challenge, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a total frustration. I immediately began to look at other things.
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of things that I think God has instilled in me to teach Jose how to lay block, to improvise in Vanuatu.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the opportunity to visit Moldova. So that, now we're going to the other side of the world.
Okay, Moldova, that is...
Well, in today's society, you'll recognize Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's right next door to Ukraine.
Right next door. Wow, okay, world traveler. All right, continue, please, yeah.
So I've had the opportunity to go to Moldova. Not for construction, but primarily I go there to teach them on church leadership. Now we're going back to my history in terms of the Bible College and my experience as a pastor out in Washington. And when I came back to Pennsylvania, I was involved in the leadership of our church. And so now what I do is I teach elders how to be elders. And that's part of my role as an elder, my area of oversight and responsibility to teach others. Well, I've used that same teaching then to go to Moldova, work at the University of Divine Grace over there, and they have students that are going to be pastors in Central Asia where you and I can't go, not safely, not if we do go, we can't go for a long period of time. These young people are coming out of there. They're getting an education. They're going back. Places probably we don't even want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's persecution and there's hardship. I'm teaching them how to train others to be leaders.
Yeah.
And so just another aspect of what God has allowed me to do through Friends in Action. And so this has been an opportunity that while we as a mission are not actively involved in Moldova any longer, the construction part that we were helping them with is over.
Yeah.
But they are allowing me to go back. I got a message last week, and they're wondering about me coming over to teach on church leadership again.
Wow.
We're looking for the spring semester. So...
So next year, 2025,
yeah,
you'll be back, more than likely. Wow, that's amazing. And so what's like one thing that has left a lasting impression on you as you've traveled, Paul, and met all these new people, you know, in spreading the gospel? What would you say is like one, whether it's an experience or like what has left a lasting impression on you?
That's a good question. Probably my response to that question would be, the thing that's left the most lasting impression on me is that I can trust God anywhere.
Yeah.
Whether it's building, whether it's teaching young men how to be spiritual leaders, I think He has taught me that I can trust Him when life doesn't go the way I think it should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we came back from Washington, for instance, I working by myself and trying to make a living for my family, and I was repairing a barn roof, a wood shake roof. I've done those before.
Yeah.
No big deal, right? Well, I was almost done. It was right down at the eave, and I was putting my last repair shingle in, and the shingle I was standing on gave out. And that quick, I was over the edge of the roof.
Wow.
I remember vaguely reaching for the rain spout, missing it. And the next thing I know, I'm laying there wondering where I was.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering how I got where I was. And as I looked, I could see the bone sticking out of my arm. And I'm saying, this is not good. Going back to my experience in advanced first aid and rescue,
mm-hmm.
that yes. I learned in Washington.
Right, I remember. Yeah, yeah.
Doing a triage of myself. And I'm saying, well, I don't want to move that arm. I know that.
Yeah.
And the farmer's wife had come out, and she had called the ambulance, and she helped me get comfortable as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to move too much because I knew you don't want to move stuff.
Yeah.
And... But even those experiences, I have found that those were times that God used to make adjustments in my life. Do I trust Him? Will I trust Him?
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of experiences that developed me into the man I am today. I like to say I trust God in every instance. I think that's a lifetime learning experience. This is always a new experience.
Yeah.
Are we going to trust Him for this? You know, I was supposed to walk my daughter down the aisle for her when she got married. And that would have been about 20 years ago. And the Monday of the wedding was on Saturday. That Monday, I had terrible pain in my gut, and I ended up in the hospital, and I had a ruptured diverticulitis. And so they had to go in and take part of my colon out. And they said, well, this is going to be like a 3-week recovery. Ooh. And I said, no. I said, I'm walking my daughter down the aisle on Saturday. And they kind of laughed at me. Yeah. I walked my daughter down the aisle. trusting God through that. But those kind of instances that are very difficult, do we trust God in those? And we say we have no option there. Well, there are options. And we find people that live in dismay, or that live in disappointment, that live in anger because things didn't go the way they wanted them to. Right? Mm-hmm. But when we realize that God has his best in mind for us at all times, then we have to look at our circumstances differently and say, okay, God, I don't like this. What is it that you want to teach me?
Mm-hmm.
And so my attitude changes, my heart response is different, and I can begin to grow. And those are the kinds of experiences that I can draw upon when I'm teaching on how to lead church leaders.
Paul, let's take a sip break. We'll take one more sip break, and then we'll wrap this up. What would you say you're passionate about in life?
Wow. What am I passionate about? Perhaps a couple facets to that. My primary passion is to see the gospel get spread. How? I'm open. Did missionary work in Alaska. We worked with a church out in the boonies of Washington. I had my own business. And there I hired missionary. I hired students who were going to be involved in missions. I hired kids out of college that were between college and their job, and I used it as a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best way to make money, because you go back and redo some stuff, and you know, every time you redo something,
it's cost. You
know, it's cost.
Yeah.
And it takes time to teach these young guys. That cost.
Mm-hmm.
But God's been faithful. I am passionate about helping people find what God would have for them in their own life. I'm passionate about people understanding that Jesus Christ desires for them to have eternal life. I am. I'm passionate about that. So what do I do with that? You know, I'm involved in my church. I'm an elder there. As an elder, I train elders. When you lived as long as I have, you know, it's not like I've lived forever.
Right. Yeah. That's because you don't look that old, Paul. Yeah. but you have knowledge and experience.
I have the knowledge. I have the experience.
Yeah.
I've been in leadership at our church when we've gone through difficult times.
Yeah.
You know, and when I've been asked to give leadership in those situations, my first response to that is to get on my knees and say, God, I don't have a clue mm-hmm. what I'm doing. I need your spirit to give me wisdom. And he does. You know, and it's not like a great revelation comes down and I see the Lord standing in front of me. You know, I don't see Gabriel giving me a scroll on what to do. You know, right. There's nothing of that nature.
Yeah.
But it's a sense that God has used me to advance what he is doing. With that understanding, with that as a background, I can trust God. Do I always? Oh, probably not. But I know I have the experience. I have the opportunity to realize that God can use even a simple farm kid like me that grew up trapping muskrats and shooting squirrels, that he can use me to teach the Jose on how to get out of the spiritual darkness, that he can use me to teach some students that are going into Central Asia what it means to be an elder, to be a leader in the church, that he can use me to be involved in leading teams and leading leaders on how to lead teams so that the gospel can be advanced through the open door that's created by our construction project. So my passion about that, yeah. Does that mean I'll be able to do that long term? my body says, Paul,
yeah,
you are 74, you know, I'm going to back off here a little bit.
No.
And
what? 74, Paul, you look great. Well, I didn't mean to interrupt, but, oh, man, I put you at, like, mid-60s. Wow. You look good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, seriously. So.
So those are things.
Yeah.
You know, I'm saying, God, I don't know what you have in mind for me, but for right now, what's the term? I'm living the dream?
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Living the dream, exactly.
Yeah. Sometimes the dreams are more closer to nightmares, but I mean, even in those situations, I see God at work. And when I see God at work, then it just tells me I can trust Him. So those are things, yeah, I am passionate about getting the gospel to the unreached. I am passionate about teaching young spiritual men on how to have that spiritual devotion and to trust God to lead others. I'm passionate to see churches being developed, and I'm passionate about seeing people reached in the unreached.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Yeah.
Just a quick story.
Oh, please, yeah.
Our daughter married a missionary kid, and they are now missionaries in Peru. And when they first went to South America, they were working with the indigenous group called the Oxinca, and that was in Brazil. Well, Brazil and Peru are neighbors.
Yeah.
And the Oxinca are in both countries. But when they were in Brazil, Kathy and I visited them. And to visit them, well, we flew into Manaus, and from Manaus we flew into another small city, and from there we caught a mission plane. Now we're talking about a 6-seater. Okay?
Okay.
And so we're flying over the jungle. And you're up there at 5,000 feet, and you can see a long way, but all I see is jungle. I see this little brown ribbon weaving through the green jungle, and that's the Jutawal River. We're following this river, and that dumps into the Amazon. We finally see a little straight strip of green grass, and that's our landing place.
That's where you're going to land.
So we land there, and we get out, and the humidity is high, the temperature is high, and the bug level is high. But we get out, and where we're going to go is down to the river. And you go out to the end of the runway, and you go down this steep bank, and you get in, go down to the river, get in these long canoes.
Yeah.
They're like 24 foot long.
One's
hand dug, and the other's an aluminum one. And they have little motors on the back, and they weave up the... Well, the Jutawal River is a pretty good-sized river.
Okay.
But the Brayu River runs into it, and that's the river we're going to go up. Up to the village where my daughter and son-in-law are ministering.
Yeah.
So we get there, we unload the plane, and of course when you fly in like that, you load the plane to the max, because you only come in there so often.
Right.
So they have fuel, and they have groceries for 6 months, and the Oxinca men are there to help, and they're carrying the fuel, they're doing all the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I are there, and they asked me, says, Paul, will you carry the eggs? Well, in Brazil, they don't refrigerate the eggs, so they can last a month, 6 weeks, or longer.
Yeah.
Well, so they gave me, I think it was 5 flat.
Okay.
You know, a flat is 2.5 dozen.
Wow.
Okay, and they have five of them.
Five of them, yeah.
4 or 5, I forget how many it was, but it was more than 2, I know that.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, I can carry that. So I'm carrying the flat, and we go down the end of the driveway, or end of the runway, I should say.
Yeah.
Now we got to go down to the river.
Right.
Well, there's no steps.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty steep. And so we're slipping and sliding, and I'm carrying these eggs, right?
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, these are precious eggs. And so I carry them down. I finally get down to the river. And I'm looking around and I see the canoes there. I said, there's no dock. Oh no, we don't need a dock. You just walk out in the river and sit in the canoe and bring your feet up. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I had water shoes on and I had some pants that were no big deal, but I got them wet.
Right.
So I take two steps out into the river and I sink into mud up to my knees.
Whoa.
Would you ever walk in mud up to your knees or halfway up to your knees?
No, I can't say I have, no. Yeah, slow going.
And so I finally get out there and I get my butt up into the canoe.
Yeah.
And I'm shaking my legs in the water to get all the mud off as much as I can. I'm holding these flats.
You got the eggs?
I got the eggs, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So we load up the canoe and it got people, we got groceries, we got whatever.
Yeah.
Fuel. We push off and we're going up the river and the one canoe is out in front and we're the second canoe there and we're chugging along and next thing you know, the motor stops. All right. And now we're not going forward. We're not going up river. Now we're floating downriver.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And the other canoe realizes we're not behind them, so they turn around and come down, and they hook a rope on, and so they're towing us now.
Okay.
And we get up to where the Brayou River joins the Juoa, and there's a little village there called Brayou.
Yeah.
Brayou de something or other. I forget what it was. But so we pull in there, and they tie us off to a stake.
Okay.
You know, there's no dock.
Yeah.
And they go up into the village and they find a guy that can work on motors.
Wow.
Okay. So he comes down and he's working on this motor. And in the meantime, I'm sitting there.
Holding the eggs. Right.
Holding.
Precious eggs. Yeah.
Holding four flats of eggs. Right.
Okay. Yep.
Now it's been like 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's 2 hours holding.
Humid, hot, holding the eggs.
Holding the eggs.
Mud all over your knees, down.
Yeah. And finally we get the motor going, and so now we're going up the Brayou River. And the river is, I don't know, 20 meters wide. Not very wide.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It wasn't very wide, but we got to avoid the sand bars. We got to avoid the down trees.
Right.
You know, we're weaving back and forth and going up this river. And finally, we get to the village where we get off for the village. And again, is you get out into the mud, up halfway up your knees,
yeah.
And you walk up and you finally get onto the dry land. And there in front of us was like 200 steps.
Oh, you got to go up steps, straight up. Like
we're going to, these steps are weaving back across this bank going up to the village.
Yeah. It never ends. Okay, so you're going up the steps.
So now I'm going up the steps. I'm carrying these five flats, and my arms are now aching.
Yeah.
Because it's been like 3 hours since we, and I finally get to the top. And I'm able to set the eggs down on the table in the house.
Oh, good. All right. Yeah.
And the eggs make it.
They make it.
And I can't move my arms.
Yeah. I'm just stuck there. Oh, okay. Good. You made it. Yeah.
Just to give you an example of what it means to be a missionary in some of these remote areas.
Wow. Yeah. It's a journey just to get to what you're doing, what you're trying to accomplish. You know what I mean? Like,
so yeah. For Friends in Action to go in and help them. I mean, I wasn't part of the team that helped build those village houses.
Mm-hmm.
But someone had to go and build those houses. So getting involved in that aspect of it, it is such a blessing to the missionaries. If they had to do that, it's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, if, and Brad, our son-in-law's father, was involved in a church plant, you know, 30 years earlier or more, And they had to build an airstrip. Took them months to build that airstrip. And what's happening when they're building the airstrip, they're not doing what they're there to do.
Right.
Friends in Action comes in, and in 4 to 6 weeks,
they're
landing an airplane.
Yeah.
See, we do what we do best, so they can do what they do best.
Now, Paul, how can our listeners connect with Friends in Action or donate, or if they want to learn more about the cause, how can they get in touch?
The best way to get in touch would be through the webpage, and that would be www.fiaintl.org. And that's the webpage you get there. There's places where you can see what we're doing presently. There's places you can see what we've done. We have pictures. We have opportunity to give. You can give to missionaries. You can give to projects. You can just give to the mission. You know, to run a mission, there's a lot of backstory or back page costs,
mm-hmm.
Operating expenses. All those things are very needful to happen, but the guy get paid somewhere.
Yeah.
And so we are a support mission. We're not associated with a denomination. So anybody can give. What they give will be a tax deduction. So they can write off their taxes. There are those who, if you have a desire to be part of a short-term mission, you can write to Paul Brosey at fiaintl.org. That'll come to me, and I can send you an application. And we can get you signed up. A lot of times what we will do is get you involved in a stateside work project first. So you get to know what we're about, and you get to understand a little bit of how the organization works before we send you to a Peru or Nicaragua or Vanuatu or someplace like that. You know, sometimes people sign up and the first trip they take is to Uganda, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first trip they take is, we had some just came back from Vanuatu, and some of those young men that went on that, it was their first time being out of the country.
Yeah.
Well, what a trip.
Oh, yeah, what a first.
it's like 36 hours just to get there. And
wow.
But, I mean, those are opportunities that they will never forget. Those are opportunities to be a part of what God is doing around the world to advance the gospel. And go to the webpage. Contact me at Friends in Action. You know, you can call me there. You know, Friends in Action has a landline. It's 717-546-0208.
Yeah.
You can ask for me, and I'd be glad to talk to you.
Perfect, Paul. Before we close out, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know?
I think the other thing to realize is that many times people's eyes are really opened to a different culture when they go out on a work team. People will realize that they can be part of getting the gospel, even though they may be scared to death to stand up in front of a group and to say something. But to swing a hammer or swing a trowel, to pull some wires, put some plumbing in, you know, those are all things that are needed, and those are all things that God uses to advance the gospel, and they can be part of that. So that's a very important, to me, that is a shift in my mental thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because back when I was 17 years old, I thought a missionary was one that had to go to Bible college, had to get and understand the Bible in order to go out and teach people about Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I also realize that if you can swing a hammer, if you can fix an engine, if you can know how to weld, you can show Christ. And so there's the my whole perspective of missions is greatly broadened. And I'd like your listeners to understand that they too can be a part of what God is doing, both here in the United States, but also potentially worldwide.
Couldn't agree more. I think that's a perfect way to end this. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for bringing this literature, this material. I will put, again, links up to Friends in Action International for all the listeners to learn more. If you'd like to donate, if you'd like to donate your time, it doesn't have to be monetary, but again, whatever you can do to help and give back, I think is phenomenal. So Paul Brosi, team coordinator for Friends in Action International on the American Grown Podcast in the Color Tech Creative Solutions Studios, thank you for joining me. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop, veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran-owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit Triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.